This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 30th of June, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, as the debt ceiling nears, the White House and Republicans fail to find common ground.
The president's availability has never been in question. We don't need any more stunts. We need a willingness for both sides to give a little.
In Maine, tribes and state leaders create a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the first of its kind in the country. And as China launches its latest bullet train, we look at the speed rail scenario in the United States. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A new study out suggests that UN peacekeepers brought cholera into Haiti after the massive 2010 earthquake. In an article published in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control's Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal, researchers found that the contamination first appeared in a river northwest of Port-au-Prince. The data strongly suggests that the contamination, downstream of a military camp, triggered the epidemic. No cholera had appeared in Haiti for the previous century. Protests erupted on the island after the outbreak, with locals accusing UN forces of bringing in the disease. But this is the first broad scientific study supporting those accusations. More than 5,000 people have died of cholera on the island since the October 2010 outbreak. Locked in a financial crisis, Greece's parliament today held a second vote on its controversial austerity program. The measures, which passed, are needed to ensure the government can secure further emergency funds from the IMF and EU. The new austerity means the country is now faced with tax hikes, pay cuts, pension reform, and privatizations. FSRN's Aris Ikemonou reports from Athens.
Protesters in Athens were in the streets all night, and actions continue today in the wake of the austerity vote. The majority socialist PASOK party and their main opposition, the right-wing New Democracy party, supported the measures. Alexandros Papadakis has been protesting the government austerity programs for the past year.
This is another example showing that PASOK and New Democracy defend the same interests. They try to fool the people and the working class, but they cannot fool us all the time. We know, and today we have more proof, that they defend the interests of industry and the monopolies. They defend the EU and the IMF, not the people.
Outside Parliament at Syntagma Square, the tear gas has not yet settled from yesterday's man-to-man battles. Like the strong smell of gas, today's vote is a reminder of the preceding 48 hours. Union-led demonstrations are expected to go into the night. Aris Ikemonou for FSRN in Athens.
Last night, riot police in Spain evicted the last remaining protesters encamped at Barcelona's Plaza de Catalunya. According to AFP, a core group of about 40 people remained in makeshift shelters in the square, left from a massive camp erected 6 weeks ago to protest austerity measures. The activists had initially agreed to leave Wednesday, but then recanted, claiming the structure the government provided in exchange was not sufficient for their needs. At its peak, the tent city housed nearly 5,000 people. In the UK, public sector workers have staged a strike and are demonstrating in cities across the country. It's the most significant sign of industrial unrest in Britain in years, but it's without the support of the political opposition. FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Pay more, work longer, get less. That's what teachers, court staff and civil service workers say government pension reforms really mean, and that's why they're striking today. The government says it can no longer afford the current pensions. They want public sector workers to pay more. They're also raising the retirement age to 66. The unions point to research by the government's own bodies that say the cost of pensions will fall over the next 40 years. What it's really about, they believe, is a race to the bottom by a ruling elite who are removed from the realities of ordinary people. The political opposition has angered unions by condemning the strike action. This means no mainstream party is behind the strikers. Members of Parliament have the most generous pension scheme in the country. There are no plans so far to reform their pensions. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Animal rights group Mercy for Animals has posted an undercover video filmed at Iowa Select Farms. The video shows piglets being thrown and smashed into the floors, having their tails and testicles removed while fully conscious. pigs with active wounds and pigs living in so-called gestation crates, which are barely larger than their bodies. The group says the footage was taken over 3 months by a woman who was hired by Iowa Select Farms in April.
We're afraid that if we were throwing them, it would mess them up.
Oh no, they're fine. Pigs are very bouncy.
The farm, in talking to media, has suggested that the video was staged but did not elaborate. Iowa Select is a pork supplier to Kroger and several other national grocers. According to PETA, Iowa and Minnesota are currently considering legislation that would criminalize the act of undercover filming on factory farms. Florida defeated a similar bill in May, and another has seemingly fizzled in the New York legislature as well. And finally, Rhode Island lawmakers passed a civil unions bill yesterday that now heads to the governor's desk. Governor Lincoln Chafee has indicated he will sign the bill into law. But many gay rights activists are not happy. They say the legislation, with substantial exemptions for religious groups, codifies discrimination. It allows religious organizations, such as some hospitals, not to recognize the unions. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. The White House and Republicans in Congress are trying to increase pressure on each other in order to get what they want out of a deal to raise the nation's debt ceiling. From the Capitol, Matt Laszlo reports.
The words debt ceiling have been tossed around a lot by Washington talking heads lately. But what does it mean? According to the Treasury Department, the U.S. government has reached its current borrowing limit and seemingly nothing happened. But if Congress fails to raise the debt limit, Joe Manarek says interest rates would go up and the effects will ripple out from there. Manarek's an economist who once worked at the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton White House.
It will also go through the rest of the financial markets to affect private securities, bonds of corporations, interest rates paid by consumers. It would send the stock market down dramatically. It would send the value of the dollar down, which will increase the cost of imported goods.
That means no deal on the debt ceiling would hit you directly in your pocketbook and could potentially dwindle your savings and investments. Both parties say they want to avoid that, but the question facing leaders now is how do they reach a compromise to avoid catastrophe? Republicans in Congress walked out of the budget talks last week because they didn't want new taxes to be a part of the negotiations. Now President Obama is the lead negotiator. In a press conference Wednesday, he struck out against Republicans, who he says are being unrealistic in their position on taxes.
We can't get to the $4 trillion in savings that we need by just cutting the 12% of the budget that pays for things like medical research and education funding and food inspectors and the weather service.
The debt now stands at over $14 trillion and rising, but the economy is still sluggish. Kentucky Democratic Congressmember Ben Chandler says the debate about whether to increase the nation's borrowing limit misses the underlying problem facing the nation.
One of the largest, if not the largest, cause of the deficit that we've got today is the recession that's taken place and the fact that not as many people are productive and working.
To get there, President Obama announced he wants Congress to help spur new infrastructure investments and to give businesses a break from paying payroll taxes. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell rejects that idea.
What I heard him propose is that we solve the debt crisis by spending more money. Solve the debt crisis by spending more money. And that we solve a jobs crisis by raising taxes.
In his Thursday floor speech, McConnell also invited the president to come to the Capitol.
Anytime this afternoon, he's available to come on up to the Capitol and meet with Senate Republicans. That way he can hear directly from Senate Republicans, why what he's proposing will not pass.
Democrats say that's purely a political move. New York Democrat Chuck Schumer says if Republicans were serious about the debt ceiling debate, they'd offer to end corporate tax loopholes and expensive subsidies for the oil and gas industry.
Leader McConnell knows that the president's door has always been open. The president's availability has never been in question. We don't need any more stunts. We need a willingness for both sides to give a little.
Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid has announced he's canceling the long-planned July 4th recess for senators.
What we have to do is too important not to be here.
For weeks, the two parties have been at loggerheads over raising the debt ceiling. Democratic leaders say they're discussing potentially bringing up tax bills one at a time to get the GOP on record about retaining certain subsidies. It worked recently to unwind ethanol subsidies, but as the stakes have increased, GOP leaders say they're not going to raise revenue as a part of a deal. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Today in China, Premier Wang Jiabao officially opened his country's latest speed train link as a passenger aboard the new Beijing to Shanghai fast train. 90 pairs of bullet trains will operate on the line with a capacity to carry about 80 million passengers a year. The trains will travel at speeds of up to 180 miles an hour but have the capacity to go faster. China, Japan, France, and Spain are some of the leading countries in the expansion of speed rail networks, but the US is lagging behind, and President Obama's $50 billion speed rail project has encountered serious political obstacles. For more, we go to Matt Van Hattem, senior editor of Trains Magazine. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Well, thank you very much.
Yesterday, the Department of Transport announced that Amtrak is borrowing more than $550 million to buy 70 locomotives for its train lines in the Northeast. How significant is that?
Well, that's crucial. Amtrak needs that equipment. I mean, those locomotives are going to be going into service on the Northeast Corridor between Boston, New York, and Washington. You know, that's the only type of high-speed rail line we have in the United States. And right now, most of the trains that are in the corridor that Amtrak owns are being pulled by locomotives that came in the early 1980s. So they're really at the end of their useful life. I mean, you wouldn't be asking a bus company to drive a bus that was built in 1981 or 1982, or you wouldn't want to drive a personal car that old. So it's time for Amtrak to replace this equipment on its fastest line in the country.
Also yesterday, Detroit's Mayor Dave Bing announced a planned $500 million light rail project. How do projects like that compare to fast train projects, and are they possibly a step towards a fast train link?
Well, that's the critical thing with city transit systems. With any kind of a public transit system, the more connections you have, the stronger they will be. Just one connection feeds on the other and allows more travel possibilities. So in terms of overall transportation in Detroit and possibly connecting to trains that are going to Chicago or elsewhere, I mean, yeah, this is good news.
You've already mentioned that one operational speed rail line in the U.S., which runs from Boston to Washington, D.C., there's another one planned to start work next year that would run from Anaheim to San Francisco through Los Angeles. Can you just sketch briefly the state of play with speed rail networks in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, other than the Northeast Corridor, that's the only one that we have right now. And yes, California is knee-deep in this high-speed rail project they've got. Those are the only two things that are close to the perception of bullet trains that other countries have regularly. I mean, even the Northeast Corridor, it's not an exclusive high-speed line the way the lines in China and Japan are. I mean, you've got commuter trains along the Northeast Corridor, freight trains are moving over it, and over this mixed-use line, Amtrak runs the Acela, which looks like a bullet train, and it actually gets up to 150 miles an hour in New England. But here's the kicker. I mean, riders love that train. I mean, Amtrak has something like 70% of the market share of the air rail travel between New York and Washington, and about 50% New York to Boston. So, I mean, it's clear people really like that train, and people like the idea of riding trains and riding a high-speed train.
China publicly launched its new speed rail link today. Is it typically then passenger traffic that's using these lines? What sort of business are these fast train lines attracting?
That's correct. For China, this line between Shanghai and Beijing will be exclusively used by high-speed passenger trains. It's an 820-mile line, so you figure that's about the distance between New York and Chicago or New York and Atlanta. The trains are going to cover that in about 4 hours. I mean, here to go that distance on a train, you'd need 18 hours. So suddenly, I mean, with a four-hour trip at that great a distance, you know, suddenly all sorts of possibilities open up. You could be a commuter. You could connect employment centers to more employees. And what it also does is then it frees up the regular network to haul more freight. Suddenly you can take freight off the road and keep your costs down, which for China as a manufacturing industrial empire, they want to do that. They want to stay competitive in the world market. So it does two things. It helps people move quicker, and it also allows their industrial base to remain competitive.
In February this year, President Obama called for a 6-year speed rail plan worth more than $50 billion U.S. dollars. What does that plan call for exactly?
You know, it's funny. The political rhetoric calls it high-speed rail, but like we've talked about, there really isn't high-speed rail in the U.S. the way we think of, and most of this money is not going towards that. There's $4 billion committed to California's project, but other than that, most of the money is going to things that, I guess, if you were to think of the highway equivalent, would be like lane widening projects or resurfacing or repaving projects or untangling highway interchanges. Basically, it's doing that for the railroad infrastructure. So what you'll see are the passenger trains we have now moving faster because choke points will be eliminated or they'll be allowed to run faster. Right now, most passenger trains run at 79 miles an hour here. Some of these projects will allow them to go 90 miles an hour, or in one place, Chicago to St. Louis, they'll eventually get up to 110.
Could you briefly explain why these fast rail projects in the U.S. have so many political problems? For example, Florida's Governor Rick Scott actually turning down $2.4 billion in federal funding for a high-speed rail project between Tampa and Orlando.
It's funny, the political problems, passenger trains require large upfront capital investments, just like highways and airports. The capital money will pay for a system. It's almost like paying for the tracks or paying for a train set, and then they're turning it over to the states and say, well, here, you know, you find someone to run it, and as the operating deficits come along, you will have to fund the difference between what comes in through the ticket prices and what it will actually cost to run the trains. That'll be up to the states to fund, and that's where a lot of states are objecting and saying, well, you know, I don't know if we want to pay for this, even though oftentimes it's just a matter of several million dollars. Some of it is ideology. They just don't like trains or don't want to pay for trains, and some of it is they're making some real financial decisions. They have to decide where to spend their money.
Matt Van Hattem, senior editor for Trains Magazine, thanks very much for your time.
Well, thanks, Danny. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
This Monday, July the 4th, FSRN will air a special documentary on the role of hip-hop in the popular uprisings across the Arab world. In countries where censorship has stifled freedom of speech, music and poetry have become the avenues for communicating political dissent. We'll take a look at how youth in Arab nations have adopted a form of expression developed in urban America and adapted it to deliver a message that reflects the reality in their region.
Hip-hop is made to sort of narrate the experiences of people who've been oppressed or marginalized. It's something that, it's a sort of easy platform for resistance in a way, because it gives a voice to people who don't have one. In terms of the Arab Spring and what's happening in the region, it certainly is a good vehicle for people to express what's going on in their own words outside of mainstream media.
Tune in for Rhymes and Revolution, soundtrack to the Arab Spring, this July the 4th on FSRN. In Alaska, on the western Aleutian island of Amchitka, a research team is investigating contamination from nuclear testing 4 decades ago. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
Amchitka was the site of 3 underground nuclear tests: Longshot in 1965, Milroe in 1969, and Kanakin in 1971, which at nearly 5 megatons is the largest known underground test by the United States. Today the site is part of the Arctic Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, and the sites of these tests are being monitored by the Department of Energy's Office of Legacy Management. Earlier this month, a 16-person team arrived on the island to take samples. Project manager Mark Kautsky is leading the team.
We're looking to see if there's any movement of radionuclides into the food chain, into the web, food web. And so we'll be sampling from the bottom of the ocean where groundwater may be discharging into the ocean.
Opposition to the original nuclear tests culminated in the founding of Greenpeace in the early 1970s. The group's oceans campaigner in Alaska is George Stepnikov. He grew up in the Pribilofs and was just coming of age when the Atomic Energy Commission and Department of Defense was using Amchitka as a Cold War testing ground.
From being a young man, a young boy on St. George Island when this happened, and watching and listening to the conversations of my parents as well as my grandfather and my uncles, they were very scared and fearful.
In 1996, Greenpeace sponsored its own expedition to Amchitka. The group claimed that past government studies had been inadequate in detecting slow-decaying radioactive isotopes. But 10 years later, a team that included the University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists studied algae in the region. It found that detectable levels of radiation around Amchitka to be similar to neighboring islands, which hadn't been the site of underground tests. Kautsky says research he's seen shows no evidence of leaks.
No detectable tritium in any of the waters, either off the island or on the island. And the radionuclide concentrations in the seafood and the food chain were below detection level.
The results from the summer's test won't be published for 6 to 9 months, but Kautsky says they will be publicly released. While Pletnikoff doesn't dispute the scientist's claims, he says he's not ready to jump to conclusions that the nuclear legacy isn't doing harm.
So far, the waste has been contained and is not leaking to the degree that will excite the people of the world to wonder why we did what we did, what can we do to mediate that. But we don't know the amounts that could or may be leaking and how that impacts the ecosystem as a whole.
Even though researchers say they've found inconsequential traces of radioactivity, the island remains off-limits to any drilling near the test sites, and Kautsky says the sampling work is projected to continue for generations. Given the slow rate of decay of the radioactive material, he says that means at least another 75 years. In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
In Maine, the state government and the Wabanaki tribes have started the process of creating a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This effort, the first of its kind in the nation, comes from over a decade of work between tribal and state welfare agencies to address the long-term effect of child welfare practices on tribes. Meredith DeFrancesco reports from WERU in Maine.
From the late 1800s through the 1970s, thousands of Native children were the target of federal assimilation policies. A 1974 survey conducted by the Association of American Indian Affairs showed that between 25% to 35% of Native children at the time were living either in foster care, adoptive care, or boarding schools away from their tribes. Denise Yarmal Altivator is a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe and part of the convening group for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. As a child, she and her sisters were placed in an abusive foster home outside her tribal community. She says no matter how they are treated, Native children removed from their tribes say they feel cultural alienation.
The one theme that everybody came up with was that when they were taken and put in a non-Native foster home outside, that they never, ever again felt or knew where they belonged. They just knew that something was missing. And for all of us, that big piece was that we didn't know where we belonged.
Although Congress eventually passed the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act to halt assimilation policies, the impacts lasted not only on the individuals removed, but on the cultural health and cohesion of tribal communities. It is this impact that the Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Maine state governments are seeking to recognize in a first-of-its-kind Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Esther Atian is a Passamaquoddy tribal member and is also part of the convening group guiding the process.
To our knowledge, there has not been a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to deal with Native issues in U.S. territory. And also to our knowledge, there has never been an effort like this that has been developed collaboratively between tribes and a state.
The roots of the commission lie in the work that both Wabanaki and state child advocates began in partnership 12 years ago. The Maine Office of Child and Family Services and their counterparts in the tribal child welfare agencies came together to create trainings for Maine state caseworkers and administrators on the Indian Child Welfare Act and its significance. Martha Prue is a manager with Maine's Child Welfare. She is also the state tribal liaison for child welfare and a member of the commission convening group.
There was so much more going on for the Native communities than just the initial referral information that was happening within the family. And there's really a historical trauma because so many Native children were removed by the state into state custody, a real kind of annihilation of the culture. And many of the folks that grew up in state custody, whether in boarding homes or in foster homes, unfortunately were abused in those situations. And there was a lot of resentment, I think, in the tribal families, rightfully so. So when we came in as child welfare staff, we weren't just dealing with the issue that was being referred, but you were really dealing with decades of trauma.
It was the child welfare advocates who proposed the truth and reconciliation process as a means to more publicly uncover and acknowledge this history and to facilitate healing. Again, Esther Atien.
When we were doing that work back in 99 and had developed this wonderful relationship between the tribes and the state, and there was more open communication, more transparency, the tribal child welfare caseworkers would still say that they were coming up against what they called an invisible wall. And we realized that we hadn't really gone back and created that common understanding. And without that, we weren't able to move forward. So we all collectively agreed that we needed to do that, as painful and as difficult of a task as it is, that it was necessary. It really is a process of decolonization that all of us need to go through.
Organizers say the commission will collect the stories of tribal members who were impacted, as well as state child welfare workers caught in a system whose aim was assimilation.
As the stories begin, the work is going to begin because communities are going to start having conversations about what happened.
Again, Denise Yarmal Altivator.
To me, the process is more important. To me, the process that we're going through, the speaking out, the community groups, the working together, Native people are going to have a space where they can have a voice. They need to have a voice. They need to be heard.
The commission will also continue to work on system reform to provide the best child welfare practices for today's Wabanaki children. Chief of the Penobscot Nation, Kirk Francis, says despite this work in Maine, other tribes throughout the country still struggle with adherence to the Indian Child Welfare Act.
It's not just about Penobscot or Wabanaki. This is a national problem. And I don't think communities have done enough to try to heal. And I think that that is one of the biggest values of this process is it allows us to tell people, you know, this is what happened. This is the historical trauma. To me, this process isn't about blame. It's about how do we overcome those issues so people can truly heal and have a conversation like adults and focus on how we go forward in a way that ensures that we're ultra sensitive to these issues and that no Native kid gets lost in the child welfare system again.
Chief Francis wants other tribes and states to consider the Maine Wabanaki model for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It is now part of the United South and Eastern Tribes agenda, and Francis has presented the model to the National Congress of American Indians. Meredith DeFrancesco, FSRN, at the Penobscot Nation in Maine.
And that's today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.